He kōna e purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
This is Media Watch. I'm Colin Peacock. Last week on the show, we looked at how New Zealand's newsrooms are using artificial intelligence technology, even if they're not making it explicitly clear to all of us. This week, we look at how AI is used to turn real news from those real newsrooms into fake news that's flooded Facebook and fooled too many Kiwis. Who's doing it? Who's exposing it? And does it matter?
I could literally look through the articles posted on the page and say, that's one of mine. That's one of mine, and that's one of mine.
But first, our flaky infrastructure has emerged as a big political issue in the past week, and not for the first time in an election year. But are the media seeing the big picture as well as the political one?
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock, 12 degrees in Wellington. I'm Max Toll. With the wastewater catastrophe ongoing, Moa Point treatment plant continues to be cleaned. What was raw sewage pouring into the water is now screened wastewater.
That was News Talk ZB last Monday, kicking off the week with the bad news on everyone's minds in the capital, the catastrophe at the plant discharging sewage from the entire Greater Wellington region. But screened sewage going down the pipe sounded a bit better, but not much.
Mayor Andrew Little says there'll be a terrible stench in areas as crews try to rectify the situation.
There's still quite a bit of work to do to remove solid waste that was part of the flooding. That solid waste has been lying around for a couple of 3 days, so the odour will be apparent.
Certainly was, and the official advice was still stay off the beaches and out of the water, possibly for months. And 30 minutes later, this was leading the next News Talk ZB Wellington News Bulletin.
Further questions about wastewater as Wellington Water battles a fresh sewage leak in Porirua. Crews over the weekend had to respond to overflow from a manhole near Mana Esplanade after pumps backed off and went off sequence.
It never rains, but it pours out to the sea and even out of manholes in Mana, further denting the Mana of Greater Wellington. Well, Porirua Mayor Anita Baker told News Talk ZB.
I'm sure we'll see more of these sort of things happening. All our pumps and our pipes need replacing, so it's just more infrastructure spending.
And she wasn't the only one saying that, as we'll hear when we look at how the media zeroed in on the big picture that she was talking about there, infrastructure letting us down. Meanwhile, there was also an outpouring of horrible headlines about the outpouring of sewage in Wellington. Here's a small sample.
Removing sewage before it goes septic is main focus of Wellington Water Company. Pretty gross. Locals shocked as raw sewage flows into Wellington Sea. How Wellington's sewage crisis exposed years of dysfunction. Wellington's sewage catastrophe exposes broken New Zealand. Where is it safe to swim in Wellington? It's a ghost town. Customers staying away after sewage spill in Wellington.
And all those were published just last Monday, and there have been plenty more like that coming down the pipe since then, but like that sewage into the Strait. The boss at the embattled Wellington Water Company, Pat Doherty, didn't sugarcoat the situation in a series of media interviews last week and last weekend. In one, he even candidly claimed they might have missed warning signs. And on Monday, he told Morning Report, underinvestment over a long period also needs to be considered in any investigation. But we've heard less from him lately after the Capital's Daily The Post reported on Tuesday that he'd been muzzled after pulling out of another scheduled media interview. Mayor Andrew Little's response when asked about that on Morning Report that same day was interesting.
We are in transition from Wellington City Council ownership and Wellington Water operating the plant to a new entity in July. For the purposes of consistency and continuity past the 1st of July, because the management of this incident is going to go past there, we need to get have an entity that is going to be around after that time. So this is about making sure that the communications, particularly the stuff about public health, which is not the responsibility of Wellington Water, is managed consistently and well, and we're getting good information out on a timely basis.
And that is an interesting point. By the time any inquiry reports back and is reported by our media, Wellington Water will have been wound up and replaced by another entity operating under the auspices of the Local Water Done Well framework. In the meantime, the soil state of the capital is now a national issue, and our national leader told Morning Report, we will be needing that inquiry. And while he was at it, the Prime Minister was also at pains to point out this was part of a national picture of stressed billion-dollar infrastructure assets.
New Zealand's Three Waters assets actually need to be making sure that they, councils are consistently investing in them year in, year out. And these are long-run assets that last 50, 70 years. And as a result, they need to be in structures that actually enable them to borrow money and make sure that they are making sure those assets are up to date. And you've seen real challenges with Wellington Water in particular, where it sort of had a hybrid model that really hasn't worked, where each council's had to chip in cash to sort of, band-aid over solutions and problems as they've emerged, rather than actually a consistent, long-term, strategic plan for managing, what are strategic assets.
Noting that Canterbury swimming spots were also closed and a rahui was in place after wastewater was discharged into Canterbury Harbour, the Herald's editorial on Monday told readers this.
It is a rude reminder to all those who've had the ability and chance to fix frequently broken infrastructure around the country, but have chosen instead to defer the problem for their successor and another day. It might be another town next month, but we will all need to cut the crap and invest in the future of this country.
Well, cutting the crap out of the South Coast outfall ASAP is the priority in the capital, of course. But that also echoed what Sunday Star Times editor Tracy Watkins had said in her paper last weekend. Under the headline, "Should we wait till we are down to our last pipe?" she also pointed the finger at all of us on the electoral roll.
We, the voters, are the real culprits. We are repeat hip pocket offenders who keep getting sucked in by politicians who milk our prejudices while avoiding the hard choices.
But another of her Post colleagues with a weekly column in the paper, Luke Malpass, pointed the finger at politicians. He reckoned Labor had squandered a chance to sort it out with Three Waters and that rate capping under National will now lock in the underinvestment.
This is about political choices. Leadership matters. So does making the case and accepting that projects are expensive, unpopular during construction, and guaranteed to attract critics, at least until they're finished.
And Luke Malpass could have added that once they are finished, they do need to keep working, unlike Moore Point right now. But as if to illustrate that it wasn't just a Wellington problem, boil water notices were issued for the eastern suburbs of Christchurch this weekend, and that followed one earlier in the week after a dead possum was found in the Roxburgh Reservoir. Meanwhile, back in Wellington, the focus of blame for what was going wrong there narrowed down to Wellington's local politicians. On right-wing blog site Breaking Views, one Peter Bassett, who was described there as an observer writing on how narrative replaces scrutiny in the media, claimed that the Wellington City Council had voted for cycleways, but not for sewage protection, 5 years ago. He zeroed in on a single committee meeting in 2021 in which a $400 million wastewater renewal program was not adopted by councillors for the long-term plan, but a cycleways option was. And Peter Bassett pointed the finger specifically at green councillors, described as zealous apostles for cycling, driven by what he called climate justice philosophy. So there was a bit of narrative along with Peter Bassett's scrutiny there as well, it seems. And he accused the media of failing to grill former councillor and now Wellington Central Green MP Tamatha Paul about her role in the decision. Now, his article was widely shared online this week and also aired on News Talk ZB by host Kerry Woodham. And it also prompted Ryan Bridge on his Herald Now show to put this crass question to Tamatha Paul.
But the question remains, what's more important, flushing the toilet or riding a bike?
Well, in response, Tamatha Paul told Ryan Bridge that no amendment was proposed at that time, which would have boosted Moa Point, and spending on water infrastructure during the two council terms from 2017 was in fact substantially higher than previous terms, which is true. Still, could it also be true that councillors with the wrong priorities made a fateful choice at that meeting back in 2021, which now means there's raw sewage in the sea off the south coast of the capital? Well, not according to one of the councillors, with responsibility for water at that time. In the Weekend Post on Saturday, Sean Rush, an energy and infrastructure lawyer by trade, said the proposed plan for wastewater would have bumped rates up by almost 6% on its own, so councillors didn't go with it. And Moore Point wasn't the focus of it anyway, he said. Major investment for a new sewage plant was coming through the sludge minimisation facility, one that Wellingtonian ratepayers now pay a separate levy for. Accelerating the cycleways, on the other hand, would boost the rates by just 0.5% more than the existing plan for cycleways, Sean Rush pointed out in the Weekend Post. And on the front page of the Post this weekend, National Affairs editor Andrea Vance laid out the startling series of faults and flubs that really did lead to sewage eventually blowing out into Cook Strait from the plant's failure. Now, she and her Post colleagues, like long-serving Wellington reporter Tom Hunt, have been on the case ever since disaster struck, and in fact, long before it too. And Post readers will have learned a lot more lately from their paper's coverage of all this, much more, in fact, than other media recycling retrospective reckons online from people with apparent access to grind about narratives in the media. While Wellington struggled with its sewage solids and liquids, the government made a bold move on gas this week in the form of a terminal for LNG to take the edge off future power shortages and price hikes. Vital or bonkers? Asked an RNZ headline reflecting the views of supporters and opponents, while News Talk ZB's morning host Ryan Bridge offered the not-so-helpful opinion.
Depending on who you ask, this is either brilliant or batshit.
Partial success or failure apparently not an option, just the extremes. Other hosts on the opinion-heavy radio station, including Kerry Woodham and John McDonald, then fell in behind the government's idea, insisting that sustainable sources of energy were just too unreliable, though they might not be if storage had been invested in instead of, or even as well as, the liquefied natural gas backstop, which of course will only be deployed when it's really needed. One of few informed commentators talking about the merits and the drawbacks of the plan was Business Desk journalist Dilipa Fonseca. He told Herald Now's Ryan Bridge he'd seen LNG terminals in action in Thailand.
At the time when they needed it, then suddenly they were put in a position where the government was subsidising the prices of electricity, and that was borrowed money to subsidise those prices. So I think that you can get into, if you're not careful with how you use it, you can get into a bad situation with some of these LNG solutions. This is also not going to arrive, I don't think, from the timeline they've outlined in time for the winter 2027, which was the whole big push for it, right?
Totally.
This was a kind of a short-term sort of stopgap sort of solution.
But as ever with political policies, much of the media coverage focused on, would it be popular? The Three News report on Tuesday, for example, began with this.
Auckland Central has more than 55,000 votes up for grabs. And voters we spoke to today shared a common concern, the rising cost of living.
And Three News' Zane Small ended his report this way.
Oh, the future's a while away. I've got to deal with today, you know. I've got to pay my bills today.
That's why campaigning on energy security for tomorrow may be a tough sell to voters today.
Meanwhile, the estimated $1 billion bill for this quickly became the focus for the media as well.
Households and businesses will face a new electricity levy. Levy, not tax, levy. The government insists the net effect will still be cheaper power.
That was ZB's Wellington Mornings host Nick Mills kicking off a full 2 hours of talkback about the policy on Tuesday and asking for someone smarter than him to tell him what's the difference between a tax and a levy. On RNZ's Midday News soon after, the Taxpayers Union boss Jordan Williams, decidedly against the plan, said it was a tax.
And I think it is a huge own goal for the National Party that in 10 months has to go to the electorate and appears to be going on the pitch that they will tax you more, Labor are about new taxes. It is frankly a political disaster for the National Party to be at this time introducing a new tax.
Though surely that depends upon whether people, or taxpayers if you prefer, see the value in paying for it one way or the other. Jordan Williams went on to say that recycling energy assets on the government's books now was really the best solution, though that, of course, would kickstart intense political rows about asset sales. But he wasn't the only one noting that when the previous government called things a levy, National, in opposition, condemned them as taxes, and now the boot's on the other foot. In the Post, Henry Cook concluded this.
Time will tell if it's just a divisionary tactic to keep the government on its toes or a sign that Labor has a properly different energy policy to bring to the table, one more focused on batteries or new generation or something else. Until then, I guess, we'll just argue about whether it's a tax or not.
And it was that argument that was preoccupying Stuff's Jenna Lynch on Three News that night.
Firstly, it wasn't a tax, it was a levy. Then the energy and finance ministers
started arguing that it wasn't a levy after all. By sort of midway through the day, we got back to it is a levy, but only on power companies. Then the coalition partners jumped in and called it a tax and a levy, one apiece. And by the end of the day, the only sort of clarity that we have on the situation is it's very, very clear the government totally botched the comms on this big time.
Well, big time botched comms may be, but it was the power of the plan to deliver more and cheaper power over time that was the real story. And it wasn't just the Post's Henry Cook that had a sense of deja vu about all this, but with the cast of political characters in reversed roles. 3 years ago, Chris Hipkins was the Prime Minister, and he was saying this.
There's just no question that we can't continue the way that we have been going. We are going to see more of these types of weather events. And so we have to be prepared. And it might not be here, it might be in other parts of the country. So we're going to have to look at very closely at how we make sure we've got as resilient an infrastructure as possible.
Well, that was in the wake of Cyclone Gabrielle, showing that our transport, telecoms and emergency systems were not nearly resilient enough. And the Cook Strait ferries had been conking out over that summer too, another recurring and not yet resolved infrastructure problem. 3 years ago, Catherine Ryan told her listeners this on Nine to Noon's political slot.
These storms now are also reminding everybody that governments actually have big issues and big problems to deal with. And we are back talking about infrastructure, for God's sake. And we're back talking about managed retreat.
But while that infrastructure deficit was real, back then, the head of the Infrastructure Commission told Newstalk ZB billions were being pumped into projects that were in the pipeline.
Currently, we're looking at about $78 billion in that infrastructure pipeline over the 5 years ahead. So that's the record for New Zealand.
Well, $78 billion sounds like an awful lot, but was it and has it helped? Well, you'd have to be an expert to know, and few in the media really are. So are they focusing on the right stuff and painting an accurate picture of the infrastructure problems rather than just the political debates? 3 years ago on Media Watch, we went to the magazine Infrastructure Asia Pacific and the website infrastructurenews.co.nz. So with infrastructure angst on the agenda again, in election year again, and featuring the same two leaders called Chris again, we went to publisher Mike Bishara to ask if history is repeating itself on infrastructure in our media.
This is an old chestnut which has come up every election for decades, right? We now have a positive chance of success, though, through a program developed by the National Infrastructure Commission. It's almost as if a mandated infrastructure pipeline for the next 30 years is too important to leave in the hands of partisan politicians. In fairness, our ridiculous three-year election cycle gives them little chance of being anything else.
Your yearbook piece, I think on the front cover it says, can the infrastructure pipeline survive politics? So big question, one the media have to consider as well. And I note in your most recent sort of electronic update, you know, the news updates that you send out to subscribers, you've got a quote in there saying, a politician thinks of the next election, a statesman thinks of the next generation. But what about the role of the media in all this, Mike, including a specialist organisation like yours?
Well, obviously, daily news reporters, they're doing their job pretty well. They don't have a lot of time for questions to evasive ministers. They've got a deadline looming in an hour or so. Look, on the news a couple of days ago, a reporter asked Minister Bishop how the government intended to fund the $50 billion roads of national significance. His first answer was that he had already spoken a couple of times about that. When asked if the government would be borrowing to pay for them or get private investment, he said it would be a blend of both. Now, you can be forgiven for thinking that this is just good clickbait in an election year. It promises benefits in some form for the length and breadth of the country, but it doesn't help our infrastructure future.
Well, we had this week the government's plans for the LNG terminal. A lot of the coverage seemed to focus on this thing of, is it a tax or is it a levy? Also, the media fixed on, is this going to be popular? Will voters have it in mind, you know, later in the year when they cast their vote? But is that frustrating for you that perhaps you'd prefer the media focus would be on, is it a good plan and the economics of it?
Well, not really. That said, the current policy of encouraging rather than controlling the use of fossil fuels is folly, and we can expect many more short-term fixes in years to come unless we get the infrastructure pipeline right.
But that focus on who's going to pay, will it, you know, will households end up facing this cost or not, or will it be the industry?
Well, yes, it certainly does that. As long as the issue is clearly out there in the public domain, we can feel that we've done our job.
Actually, our spending on infrastructure is fairly significant, but we're getting really poor returns. Is that the message you think, you know, media need to get out, and the people need to understand that even if we bump up the spending, it's the returns we're getting and the productivity that's the real problem?
Well, productivity is the key. That's the root cause of all our problems, of course. For example, in the report, there's a quote there that relates to, we have 1,175 regulations in 68 territorial authorities. Now, we have infrastructure providers have to wade their way through all this. Japan, for example, has 13. To be honest, there's not a great deal of urgency put on that. They are far more comfortable dealing with little sound bites of problems and hoping that the media just concentrate on answering that question.
The last line in your article in the yearbook is really interesting. It says that it might also mean taking a more commercial approach to infrastructure, whereby we lift the bar on project quality, finding new projects that households and businesses will be more willing to pay for. Is that kind of where the media come in? Because if the government does decide to follow that, that will mean trying to push a message out by whatever media channels that things that cost are worth it. And, you know, a bit of spin maybe that the media will have to decode. Do you think when the election does roll around, it's the end of November, that people will be thinking about these issues and parties will be putting them forward in the media? Or is it all going to be kind of drowned out by the kind of more relatable cost of living issue that the media really does focus on a lot?
Well, I don't think so. The issues will be well aired. I think our media coverage is just fine. The daily reporting that we see on TV is well-balanced and researched. We have excellent publications around like NBR. We've got commentators who do address these issues with ministers directly. But what we have to have is a lot less government and infrastructure and a commitment across all political parties to hold sacrosanct certain mandated infrastructure necessities.
And you think media might be able to play a role in that, actually, you know, for sort of maybe the more, rather than platforming the political point scoring, you know, actually encourage that bipartisan national interest stuff? Is there a way of doing that?
There is a way of doing that, but that requires some degree of cooperation from politicians themselves. No matter how good a journalist is, if you keep asking the same question and getting the same answer, it's very hard. And so that leaves the role of people who have the time and capacity to investigate the statements. But companies like ours often get picked up by the daily media. So we're very happy with that. So yes, the media remains pivotal in its reportage of the election. Our daily reporting is fine as far as I'm concerned.
That was Mike Bishara, the publisher of the magazine Infrastructure Asia Pacific and the website infrastructurenews.co.nz, who, as we heard there, recently wrote about his fears that the current infrastructure plans might be scuppered by partisan politics. He wrote about that in his recently published Infrastructure News Yearbook for 2026. Last weekend here on Media Watch, we heard how news organisations here are using AI technology. And even though most reputable news outlets here have pretty firm policies now on AI, they're not always telling us exactly how they're using it. But what we didn't talk about was non-reputable news outlets posing as legitimate ones online and using AI to rip off and repurpose legitimate news, and in doing so, damaging trust in those same legitimate news outlets. And that was thrown into sharp relief this week by RNZ and TVNZ. RNZ's Explainers editor Nick Durga, in association with the fact-checking service of Australia's national news agency AAP, dug deep into the problem of AI slop from an online outfit called NZ News Hub, which brazenly co-opted the name of the former TV news service, which was closed down amid cost-cutting 2 years ago. NZ News Hub posts feature AI-generated images and video, which aren't identified as such, and they're made from legitimate images and information scraped from real New Zealand media outlets, including RNZ. So what sort of fake news is flooding Facebook like this? Well, Nick Durga found warped stories that were hyping up and misrepresenting genuine news events here, including tragedies like the recent landslide at Mount Maunganui and the recent tour boat sinking off Akaroa. The treatment of that one dialed up the drama by adding extra passengers at risk in AI-rendered illustrations, while wrecked cars and houses were gratuitously added into the Mount Maunganui fake news posts about that slip. Another post even scraped a genuine still image of a 15-year-old victim of the Mount Maunganui landslide. And here's Nick Durga on Afternoons with Jesse Mulligan telling the host all about that.
Yeah, that one, you know, you try and be objective as a journalist, but that one really offended me on several levels. That lots of stuff about the Mount Maunganui landslip, and one of the ones that we spotted was a image of the 15-year-old girl who died in the landslide. She was a dancer, and the family had released an image of her dancing to police. This picture was taken, and using AI, it was animated. So she was doing these sort of bizarre, almost physically impossible breakdancing moves over a jaunty soundtrack, and the post was, you know, just very grotesque almost to see somebody who had died in a tragedy like this being used for clickbait.
Another AI-generated video on the site purported to show the Prime Minister at Waitangi discussing the November election with Finance Minister Nicola Willis. And these were completely fake news and images, neither of them very convincing. So who is it who's actually doing this? Well, here's Nick Durga again on Afternoons last Monday.
Well, this particular one, it lists a Wellington address, it lists the Wellington phone number, none of which actually check out when we dug into them. They appear to be just spoofing other businesses. A lot of these pages tend to be run from countries like Vietnam or Malaysia, and they tend to hide their identity as much as they can.
Often, we've done interviews on this before, the people doing the grunt work are often exploited or trafficked themselves, so it's a pretty nasty business. Dare I ask, is Facebook, is the parent company Meta doing anything about this stuff?
They talk a good talk about doing a lot of it. And they you do report stuff and you do see it getting taken down, but it's like playing whack-a-mole. That, you know, the same person behind this may set up 10 similar pages in the time it takes to blink an eye. And I don't really know what the answer is to deal with it until, you know, the publishers of these websites really take full account of you for everything they're putting out there. But at the moment, it's like the Wild West, you know, just anything goes.
And the same day that RNZ published Nick Durga's account of all that, TVNZ digital reporter James Ball identified at least 10 Facebook pages publishing such AI slop. Now, none of them are doing any original reporting. It's all AI-rendered recreations of stuff scraped without permission from real New Zealand news sources. Now, sometimes, James Ball noted for TVNZ, this was done so badly that AI prompts were erroneously published in the actual online posts, like this one.
Here's a new style rewrite with a clear headline, emojis and top hashtags. If you want, I can also make this shorter, more dramatic, or social media style.
Clearly pretty sloppy stuff, though. Thousands of New Zealanders have been liking and sharing it on social media. Until this week, that is. After the exposure, NZ News Hub posts have vanished from Facebook. So, good outcome. But if there's money to be made with this sort of AI slop, then other news-like outlets will emerge. But in the end, does it matter much if the easily duped people are fooled by it? Well, it does to the former Herald editor turned media scholar Gavin Ellis, who said this in his weekly blog, Nightly Views.
My fear is that when they realise they're being duped, their anger and embarrassment will not be limited to the slop makers, but extended to all media.
Gavin Ellis feared that people might end up deciding you can't trust any of them, especially when part of the scam is that this sort of AI slop and fake news can turn up in online searches for news in much the same way as real news from real news outlets. Bill Hickman is an RNZ reporter whose stories have been scraped by these online outlets, including that dodgy Facebook site, NZ News Hub.
I was having a look online following the the heavy weather that hit the northern parts of the North Island about a fortnight ago. I came across this page, Facebook page, and I could literally look through the articles posted on the page and say, that's one of mine, that's one of mine, and that's one of mine. And the first thing that tipped me off about this was a particular comment from a resident in Hicks Bay, a woman that I'd spoken to. I knew that that had come from my article, that I was the person that spoke to her, that I was the only person she'd talked to. And then I looked in the comments. Then I saw my contact commenting about the use of her name and the use of the comments that she had made towards me when I interviewed her, and pointing out on the comments that she had not given permission to the site to use her comments, and asking that the article be pulled down, which, of course, it wasn't at that point in time.
So she only wanted and expected to see comments she'd made to you to appear on RNZ's site and in their news stories.
Yeah, I think it's a reasonable expectation. I mean, obviously, we have our sharing agreements and we share with other organisations, but it's always attributed.
It's irritating, and surely, you know, for an organisation and for an individual journalist like you to have your stuff taken like that. But in the end, do you think now that the site seems to have gone away after this exposure, that in the end it's sort of no harm done?
No, I don't think you can say by scraping an article and rewriting it and not attributing where its sources come from that it isn't plagiarism. I mean, if I was, as a journalist, sat down, looked at other articles that people were writing and wrote my own article on that, using that as the source, even extracting quotes from these articles, and didn't attribute it, I'd get fired. But of course, we've also got to remember that this is an evolving technology, and that right now, this stuff is quite easy to spot. It's interesting that people find it less easy to spot the use of AI to scrape these articles and to reform these articles in text, of course, because you have to have an awareness of the original article to really see it being done. But it is being done. The use of AI to do this with text is plagiarism. It's not fair to say that it's not.
Once people look at it and realise, as you said, some of these aren't very convincing at this point, maybe it makes other, you know, better, more reliable and legitimate media look better. You know, reinforces the fact that this is something you can rely on. Or alternatively, like the former Herald editor Gavin Ellis, writing about this week, said his fear is that if this stuff is surfaced in news searches along with the stuff that is legitimate and does withstand scrutiny, effectively the stuff it's ripping off, everybody's trust in all media will come down a bit because people will say, you can't trust any of it. Do you share his fear about that?
I totally do, especially as the stuff gets harder and harder to spot.
So in the end, not a pleasant experience to be scraped.
Not a lot of fun, no.
RNZ reporter Bill Hickman talking to me there earlier this week. Well, as we heard, the exposure of NZ News Hub's AI amplified plagiarism has killed off that particular outlet, for now at least. So if you see it, do report it. But last year on Media Watch, we looked at how reporting another type of fake news on Facebook that's damaging trust in real news didn't seem to help much at all. Posts of sensational but made-up stories about well-known people were co-opting the logos of real news outlets like TVNZ, RNZ, and The Herald. And most of these were in the end gateways to scams looking to snare gullible people. Last week, News Talk ZB's Mike Hosking told the visiting global head of safety at Facebook's owner Meta, Antigone Davis, that he'd been one of the victims of these fake news scam posts himself.
I've got a profile in this country and I've been on the end of any number of scams. And I look at those and I think, if you can't see that, you're an idiot, because they're not that good. And yet, people fall for them all the time. I'm assuming that's only going to get worse.
The bad actors, because they're adversarial, will always try to get better and get around our systems. But the technology gets much more sophisticated. So, for example, in sort of that clickbait of popular public figures, we're now using these facial recognition tools and testing them to stop that type of scam.
Well, it hasn't stopped yet, in spite of what she said there. But the reason that Meta's global head of safety was here in the first place was to push back at our government, which is proposing to ban under-16s from social media services like Meta's Facebook and Instagram. And when Mike Hosking returned to that on his show this week, he said this.
I, for example, have no doubt that companies like Meta could have, should have, done more to target scams and harm and bad actors. I have no doubt that Zuckerberg and co. love the bottom line more than they love anything else, with the possible exception of power and control. What tech through social media, though, has done is amazing. Amazing and yet terrible.
But if taking out the terrible stuff would cost them money, recent history shows that Meta's not really that bothered, especially in smaller markets like this one. Until the government's threatened to sanction them, that is, which is when the likes of Meta's head of global safety might turn up here and talk to our media. This week, Mike Hosking reckoned that banning big tech social media platforms for young people just won't work, and New Zealand shouldn't bother to try.
In Australia, it hasn't worked, or at least certainly not as well as they would have liked, but that is the sad interface between reality and politics. That's why France and Denmark and Spain are all over it, maybe Britain as well. Liberal governments who favour headlines over results, which is where our government is potentially going to disappoint me.
But interestingly, one of the reasons governments, including ours, are now pursuing social media bans is what New Zealander Sarah Wynne-Williams revealed in her book Careless People, a whistleblowing account about how Meta and Facebook exploit the reach of the online technology that they have developed. But unlike Meta's Antigone Davis, Ruth Wynne-Williams can't tell that story about her former company here or anywhere. Meta has obtained a court order under which she could be fined almost $100,000 anytime she speaks in the media anywhere about what's in her book. That's because of non-disparagement provisions in her previous employment arrangements with Facebook, which seems inconsistent with her former boss Mark Zuckerberg dialing back the moderation and monitoring of Facebook posts last year in order to, he says, enhance freedom of expression. That's it for this week. Thanks so much for listening. If you have any thoughts for us or ideas for us to follow up, do get in touch. Email us at mediawatch@rnz.co.nz, or you'll also find us at MediaWatchNZ on X. And you can even write us an old-fashioned letter and send it to MediaWatch, PO Box 123, Wellington. Catch you again for Midweek Media Watch next Wednesday. In the meantime, follow Media Watch and listen on any podcast app to make sure you never miss an episode.